Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you the 2026 Masters Champion, Rory McIlroy.
I thought it was so difficult to win last year because of trying to win the Masters and the Grand Slam, and then this year I realized it's just really difficult to win the Masters. Yeah, I don't make it easy. I used to make it easy back in my early 20s when I was winning these things by 8 shots. But no, it's just, it's hard. It's hard to win golf tournaments.
Congratulations, Rory. What do you think this tournament and this golf course has taught you about life?
Good things come to those who wait, maybe. Just keep going. You know, if you put the R's in and you work on the right things, you know, eventually it'll come good for you.
Say a few thank yous to the people on my left. First and foremost, my wife and daughter, Erica and Poppy. You know, this has definitely turned into Poppy's favorite week of the year. I don't know if it's because of the par 3 tournament or it's all you can eat ice cream in the player services building, but my mom and dad, they weren't here last year to celebrate with us. And surprisingly, I had to convince them to come this year because they thought that the reason that I won was because they weren't here. So I'm glad that we proved that wrong. But Mom and Dad, I owe everything to you. You are
Well. Let's just kick off, shall we? Dave McIntyre, Gary Murphy. I guess we'll start with this one. As emotional as last year or not?
Definitely not.
Okay.
It was actually a little bit more enjoyable, I think, than last year. Last year was just panic at the disc golf for 4 hours, and it was exhausting and frightening. I think his tee shot in 18 last night was a little bit of that too, but no, this was way more enjoyable. And even I think for the neutral, it was probably, you know, there was quite a few permutations. There was kind of 3 or 4 winners at one stage, and it was a really good, you know, if you're not even involved, I think it was a really good Masters to watch, with many different storylines throughout the evening. It's great. Really enjoyed it.
I'm very happy to hold up my hands, Dave. The two of you guessed the winner. I mean, even if you were leading with your heart, you still got it right. I thought Cam Young had the momentum and, you know, on the fifth hole, I was like, oh my God. I'm going to be right, and I don't really want to be right. What he did then, say, on certainly on the backside, I think was something for the ages. And maybe I've got, like, just, you know, I'm a bit tired. I was up, quite emotional. It was all very something, but to try and, for me, it was, I think it heralded something truly, truly special in not just his career, but in just golf generally.
Yeah. I don't know where to start, Fionn. I'm going to start by saying something that I think I also said to anyone who would listen last year. I know I wasn't with you guys last year, but I feel sorry for anybody and everybody who doesn't love the Masters. I have a deep pang of sympathy and pity for those people. It's not something I felt every year. When Zach Johnson won in 07, I was envious of those people who don't watch the Masters. But almost every year, how can you not love what we watched last year? and what we watched over the last 4 days. So my condolences to everybody who, none of whom are listening to this podcast, but my condolences to all of those who are not deeply in love with Augusta and the Masters major tournament. Going on from everything you guys have been saying, it was so much more enjoyable. Last year was gripping beyond belief, but it was also car crashy in equal measure. And there was a fearfulness for everybody that had even a semblance of a foot in the McIlroy camp throughout, that he was going to screw it up yet again, and that there was going to be more Masters heartache and this Grand Slam would never be completed. All of that was taken away from this whole series of emotions for this year, which made it so much more enjoyable. And yes, I have to say that the way he played the back nine was Tiger and Nicklaus-esque. Hang around like a dirty smell for long enough to watch everybody else slit their own throat. And yes, so obviously McIlroy, as he mentioned there at the top of the show, has won majors pulling up. He's won at a canter. And Tiger did that a couple of times, did it in 97 at Augusta. He did it at Pebble Beach in 2000, did it once at the Open, and a couple of others that I'm probably forgetting. But an awful lot of the time, Tiger just hung around and waited for everybody else to drift off. And that's what McIlroy did this time. I mean, he went bogey free from the 6th all the way through to the 18th, when, you know, one of the reasons he did take a 5 was because he knew he could. I think he would have been way more aggressive with that bunker shot had he needed to get up and down to win the tournament. He has died on a golf course so many times over the years that there is literally nothing left that the game can throw at him that he can't handle and that he hasn't seen before. And so when he makes that double followed by another bogey on the front nine, it must have been very easy for him to hit the reset button and say, lads, we've been here before. Like, this is nothing we haven't seen. We went through the ringer last year. We had 4 double bogeys over the course of the 4 days. And we still ended up putting the green jacket on afterwards. And so he played like a grizzled, gnarly veteran in the last 12 holes or so.
Yeah.
And I think it bodes incredibly well for him for what's going to come down the tracks now, these final chapters of his career.
And it's exactly to that point, Gary. I can't remember which it was. It might have been 10 years ago. But I remember Rory started the Sunday. He had an eagle putt on 2 that he missed. And it almost just felt like the air just went out of his sails.
And it was against Reed in 18, wasn't it?
Was it 18? So 8 years ago. Exactly. Yeah. And I thought at the time, is this the body language just as one who'd beaten himself before the final round had even gotten going? Whereas yesterday, I don't think he overpowered Augusta as much as solved it. And to Dave's point, Gary, this is a victory that was built on experience, on restraint, on being able to adapt to the circumstances presented to him. We'll talk about like the way he solved the 12th. And to me, it signals this shift from someone who was unquestionably, like, you know, once in a generation talent, but volatile, to a complete major champion.
It's the flip, I think, you know, because his endearing qualities are that he does have a vulnerability, like all of these guys do, because they're human beings. But I think it's kind of gone from a want now to a need. And there's less of a lean on the panic button in those scenarios.
Is it not the other way around?
Or the other way
around. A need, less of a need, and more just a want.
Yeah. And I think there's less of a lean on the panic button because of that. It was, although I think 6 was huge for Cameron Young. I think missing that short putt out of the blue put a bit of panic in him. Now, I don't know what happened, because there was some issue with the rules official on 13, where they went over to chat to him. I don't know if something had happened and that was kind of playing on his mind too, but because he started off really composed. But I just think Rory he's moved. My euphoria last night was more so that this is a 6th major and this is another step forward. These things are phenomenally hard. They're hard to play and never mind bloody win the things, but there's no time like the present to do it. It's 6 majors now. He's gone ahead of Seve, which is historic in its own right, and he's tied with Faldo. And I don't think, as he alluded to in his presser afterwards, you know, the reaction from this win will be completely night and day with last year. So he's kind of, and he beat Scheffler by a shot. That's another, you know, we I think we're all in agreement that, you know, when Scheffler is on week in, week out, he's the best player in the world. That's an excitement factor for McIlroy to try to close that gap in the world rankings. And winning majors is the best way to do that. But he just looked a lot more composed. I don't know what happened on the 18th tee, to be honest. I was surprised he did that because he melted two tee shots down there last year in the 72nd hole in the playoff. But maybe that's just a little bit of Rory that we love. You know, there was a bit of drama right to the end. But he was very assured in that march.
There were so many moments.
It's pitch on 17 as well. Like, that looks so easy on the TV, and it's just not easy at all.
Well, we'll talk about a short game.
He loves that shot, doesn't he, though? It's at 17. He should put himself there every time he plays that hole.
Yeah. So afterwards, Rory had, in his mind, he'd picked 15 under as the number. And he felt, you know, starting on 12, 3 under, I don't think anyone will get past that. So, like, as a golfer, you have that number in your mind. Standing on the seventh tee, he's at 9. Mm-hmm. And it feels that 15 under is just so far away. And it would be very, very understandable if not just doubt, but like panic set in. And instead, he goes birdie 7 and 8 and starts that fight back. And then also, look, like, you know, Amen Corner bit the hole off him the day before and he owned it yesterday. I'm just thinking again, just in terms of resilience, a sense of like, look, when you don't have your best stuff, and even he himself said, like, he, you know, he had a B swing, like, to be able to do what he did from the seventh on, to me, and coupled with, and Gary, you're right, like, Cam's miss at 6, I think, was like, okay, all right, you know, he's not going to hurt me right this second anyway. But Cam had a 3-shot lead on him at one point, you know, and then just to be able to claw back that advantage, to me, just speaks of resilience that we haven't seen in previous iterations of Rory McIlroy.
Yeah, well, I suppose he knows there's never any need to panic. Like, he had a 4-shot lead making the turn last year and threw it away. We've seen major collapses. Like, we talked Friday night, is it over? I don't think any of us felt that it was over, obviously, because the whole thing can just be turned around so quickly at that golf course. So, yeah, 3 behind, but at no point was there any need to go looking for the panic button. And he would have done in the past, obviously, but and started chasing things and maybe started attacking pins that he shouldn't be doing. But he managed to hit the right shots in the right areas. I think on 12, I don't think that's exactly where he was going. I think he was probably looking to go 3 or 4 yards left of that. And it just faded a bit more and turned into an absolutely gorgeous golf shot. A part of his game, and I think I just wanted to mention this, and you kind of mentioned it briefly there, Fiona, is that he's obviously a headline reeler. He is the greatest driver of the golf ball probably that we've ever seen. He hits these towering iron shots into greens. I don't know, is it a bit of a stretch to suggest that he has the most underrated short game in the world? Like, we talk about Harrington and Lowry and Reed and Tiger. These guys with unbelievable games around the green. But right now, who's a better chipper in and pitcher in the world than McIlroy?
Like, well, Scotty Scheffler, I'd argue. But
maybe him, the world number one, fair enough. But like, if you think of the shot that he hit in Rome at the Ryder Cup, that had everybody, including his playing partner, almost vomiting on themselves. And the hole out on 17 on Friday night. Like, I don't know if there's anyone else in the world that can play those shots. The shot that he played on 13 yesterday, where he hit a brilliant drive, probably the best of the week that he's hit in the par fives, and then completely overshot the green. And made getting up and down from there just look so easy. The little pitch he played, or the putt he played off the back of the green on 16.
Yeah,
maybe it's an easier shot than it looks because of the way the green moves. And we've seen some guys hole out from positions, namely Tiger Woods in that situation in the past. But his ability to get the ball up and down and scramble is totally underrated, in my opinion.
But Gary, would you not make the argument to kind of build on Dave's point that, like, Augusta, you can't win at Augusta unless you have an elite short game. And if you look at all the winners, like from Ollie to, you know, to Seve, to Tiger, and then more recently, like Patrick Reed, Scheffler, Ram, Spieth, and so on. Spieth, like every one of these, exactly to Dave's point, has the ability to get it up and down from like incredibly tight lies to, you know, to unbelievably tough pin positions.
And you can't, the other side as well, you can't win six major championships unless you have an all-around game.
Yeah.
You know, you can win one here and there and whatever the case may be, or maybe two. That's a bit of a stretch. But like six majors is just so many. It really is. Like a side, like he's what, four majors ahead? Well, no, he's ahead of Brooks Koepka now. He got five.
Yeah.
You know, so he's the most winning of this generation, the last 10 years or so. Or 15, what's the generation? 15 or 16 years,
I suppose, yeah. Put back to Mickelson, I suppose, of the next crop after that.
And he's tied with Mickelson, you know. And if you look at Phil Mickelson, my goodness, what, you know, it's almost beyond a Hall of Fame career. So it's frightening company. He's tied, I think, with, is it Trevino as well now? So yeah, it's you have to have an all-round game to be able to achieve those things. And I do agree with the point massively. There's such a sexy factor to, you know, watching someone's ball speed and the distance they hit the ball. But short game and putting is, it's very rare that you would get elite level distance players with an elite level short game. And that's kind of what he has.
Yeah.
I think he's always had it. Like that shot in Rome, it's just so hard to do that.
Mm.
Like it's actually, if I was out practicing with 50 balls, I might do it once or twice. And to do it in the cauldron of a Ryder Cup on the second last hole, I mean, frightening ability. That's a high end, very, very few people can hit that golf shot.
John, can I throw a couple of stats at you there?
Yeah, go on.
As per our friends at Data Golf, on Friday night, his win probability was 69%.
Yeah.
At one point yesterday, it fell as low as 11%. 11% win probability. And that is, if you want anything that sums up Augusta, that is it. Scottie Scheffler played the last 36 holes in 11 under par. Like,
no bogeys. First, the only player ever not to get.
Didn't win. Yeah. He didn't win the tournament.
Yeah.
How does his putt stay out in 17?
Oh, 17, like, Jesus Christ. We'll talk about that in a second, because that would have been, like, I think that would have made Rory's tee shot on 18 an entirely different thing. Had Scheffler's putt dropped. I can't believe it didn't drop. Yeah.
If you had said to Rory McIlroy when he was 12 under that you're going to play the next 36 holes in level par, he would have thought, well, that's me done. I have absolutely no chance of winning then. In terms of Rory and Scheffler, they've won four of the last five Masters. They've won four of the last five majors between them. Like, this is a proper rivalry now. It is just brilliant. Rory beat Scheffler yesterday. He didn't beat him on the day, obviously, in terms of the scores they shot, but he had Scheffler breathing down his neck and he held him off. Next month in Aeronomic, it's a golf course we know nothing about. They haven't been there since the BMW was played there 8 years ago. So that's a bit of an unknown quantity. But for the US Open at Shinnecock, Rory's going there to try and ensure that Scotty does not complete the Grand Slam.
I know. It's quite tasty.
That is mouthwatering.
Yeah. I want to talk, we'll talk about legacy, obviously, and what it all means, etc. But like, I want to get back. So, had he not made, and Gary, this one's more for you. Had Rory not birdied 7 and 8, it would have meant he would have had to go more aggressive later on, and you open yourself up to making more mistakes. Now, that also taken into account that it seems, well, just judging from a very far distance, that it's much, much harder to lead at Augusta than it is to chase, that it weirdly rewards chasing. But like, even if you allowed, so those two birdies were obviously crucial to his fight back, but it felt on 12, which is notoriously difficult, as we all know. And then in the presser afterwards, he tells his story about having played a practice round there with Tom Watson in 2009 and asking Watson, like, what's the approach here? And he goes, wait for the wind to be what you want it to be and then hit it really quickly, which seems such a basic bit of advice, but such a key bit of advice. And he clearly did the same. And
that's scary, though.
I know it is.
What if the wind changes after you, when the ball is in the air?
The wind is swirling all the time. So you got to wait for it to be just like, just the way you want it to
be. I know, but what he means by that is your commitment on the shot.
Yeah.
You know, you're less likely to miss it when you're committed to a shot.
Yeah.
And you're less likely then for the ball to get eaten up by the wind. If it's a miss hit, you know, there's going to be way more spin on it. So, that's the thing. You balloon that up in the air, your goose is going to get eaten alive.
And the other thing that I loved about that shot was this, right? Now, and we here at Golf Weekly, maybe not so much you, Gary, but I certainly have over the years, one of the things we've been most critical of Rory about is going full bore with those shorter irons. Like, just hit, he hit a beautiful three-quarter nine there. Like, it was so controlled. And, like, to me, it was just like, oh, my God. Like, that was just, it was unbelievable. No?
I think it's probably the best shot from a champion there in a long time.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of a marker, and then he belted it around the corner on 13. And I think to your previous point, if you look how Rose reacted when he got the lead, it was very different.
Oh, he started backing off everything.
Yeah, he came off, I think, three times maybe.
Yeah.
And then, like, the three-putt on 13 was just knife in the heart stuff, really. Yeah. But I don't think he was trying to putt to hold the first putt, which was surprising to see him hit it that far by. But, yeah, he just... I think that's a big hurt for Rose, that final...
Well, the Duffy chip on 12... Like, yeah. I know he was trying to control the shot, but he duffed a chip. Like, he looked, again, and maybe I'm being terribly unfair, but he looked very indecisive when he hit that. And
he was between two shots.
He was between two shots.
You know.
And obviously on television, we can't tell how much the wind is swirling. So, but clearly it was getting up. And the infamous swirling winds of Augusta, but they clearly were a factor. Well, certainly for Rose, as we said, like, I mean, he kept stepping away, stepping in. And that, like, if anything, not only puts doubt in your mind, but it also kills momentum. And, oh.
I wonder, will this hurt Rose more than the two playoff defeats?
Oh, massively, yeah, massively.
Because he played brilliant golf in 2017 against Sergio. He was absolutely incredible last year, but he played the back nine in two over yesterday.
Yeah.
And he lost by two shots.
Yeah,
like I think that's going to take a while to get over. He only had one birdie on the back, three bogeys. He looked so uncertain of himself. He was the last person on the leaderboard outside of Scheffler that I expected to behave in that way on the back nine. I thought Rose was going to take some stopping once he put himself in that position, and he looked like a guy who hasn't been up there before, the way he played the back nine.
Yes, it really is at odds with everything that we know about Rose as a golfer, who's meticulous, incredible strategy, knows when to attack, knows when to take risks, knows when to kind of pull. And it just seemed to all disappear. Once he hit the lead, it felt like it all just kind of disappeared on him.
That's the beauty of Augusta, though. And that's the difference between chasing and trying to protect. If you look how different Rory was yesterday compared to Saturday. So I think when you get in, obviously, I don't know because I haven't played the Masters, but I think when you get in a defensive mind frame around there, it just eats you up.
Yeah.
You know, and even if I know it played easier on Saturday, but Rory was defensive on Saturday. Everyone else is just, the whip is out and they're going full throttle. They're galloping as much as they can. And Rose was like that for 2 hours. And then he, you know, even on 10, when he knew he did a perfect number and he came off the shot and his caddy, you know, confirmed, listen, let's just kind of do it. It's right. So just that little tiny bit of, I need to be perfect here. And we obviously know that's not how you play golf.
My pick for yesterday was Cam Young, who didn't collapse. I don't think, maybe you guys think something else. I thought he played well enough tee to green. I thought like he had multiple birdie chances. We mentioned the key misses on six, and then just it felt like the putter went ice cold on him after that. Like, I thought he hit enough quality shots to win by multiple strokes. Like, I thought he played well, but just, again, just failed to convert putts when he had to. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. Is there anything else that we can say?
I don't think he's an elite level putter, and he was in new ground yesterday.
Yeah,
I know he's one of the players, which is a huge event in its own right. And maybe that's something for him to learn from going forward and find a little solution to that. Whether it was, you know, it can be many different things. Whether he just wasn't trusting his reads and then he was getting in between strokes, or whether he was just too nervous and grip pressure or whatever, those little nuances that happen to him, he has to learn from that, because he's a fantastic golfer to watch.
He wasn't even threatening the hole, though, was he?
No. He lost his nerve a bit.
And I think to an extent as well, his luck ran out, because Saturday was farcical, the manner in which he got some of the breaks that he got. Like, he avoided losing six or seven shots with some of the breaks that he got over the course of the 18 holes. And at some point, your luck does run out. Like, McIlroy got an awful lot of luck on Thursday and Friday, and his luck ran out on Saturday, and he just managed to survive and stay above water. I think McIlroy got a huge break on 18 as well. His tee shot was so bad, it was nearly good. But I'm not sure Cam Young will be hugely damaged by yesterday's back nine. He will be able to say to himself, I've won the Players and I've got into the final group at Augusta and I've only lost by two. And yes, he shot over par on the final day, but played the back nine in level par and didn't get a single putt to drop. It'll be easy for him to reset. I would have him as a huge favourite for, or amongst the favourites for, the PGA Championship in 4 weeks' time. I think he'll take a huge amount from what he's done over the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, because Gary, I'd agree with Dave there, because it suggests that Cam Young is a very, very high ceiling with some inconsistencies that experience will iron out.
Oh, totally, yeah. I think even we saw the way he's performed here at the Open. Birkdale is a big golf course. It's a hard game of golf. I think that will suit him. He was sensational around St. Andrews. I know Cam Smith got all the adulation for winning, but like, Rory finished third, Cam Smith was second. So it was two guys beat him that day, not just Cam Smith. But Cam Young won in St. Andrews. Cam Young was second in St. Andrews, shooting 66
the
last
other way
days.
Around. Gary, Cam Smith won in St. Andrews, Cam Young.
Yeah, Cam Young was second in St. Andrews. He shot 66.
Yeah.
And Smith shot 64. So he's got good previous. And it's a stepping stone. Like, he's new to this. He's not been around a long time, and he's had an unbelievable start to his career. He had a fantastic Ryder Cup last year. And, you know, these things happen. You see it a lot of the times, guys that just miss out on majors and then go pick up a couple of them. So whilst he'll be hurting today, he's a lot to take from it.
Fionn, I know we're probably going to get on to Shane and we'll probably circle back around to Rory before we finish, but can I just mention Scheffler for a minute?
We're going to talk about Scheffler right now.
Great. There was a couple of things. The par fives absolutely killed him. I think Rory was 6 under for 13 and 15 over the 4 days. Scheffler was 1 over.
Yeah.
And he lost the tournament by a shot.
Yeah.
Like, you could almost, that encompasses his week. But the other part of it was, I just wonder, playing with Hao Tong Li yesterday.
So let's get into that. What happened on 13 was, did you followed this, didn't you, on 13?
Yeah.
Hao Tong Li picking up balls out of red zones. I'm like, what are you doing? Red state, you don't even know the rules, man. Like, he picked up a ball in a red stake area. But like,
Scheffler had to wait 6 minutes at one point.
And then when eventually he was on the green, he put it off the green into the water and had to wait again. Look, I'm sorry, that I'm not putting this. Hao Tong Li wasn't very slow on purpose. Look, stuff happens, whatever. It went. But, I mean, that didn't help him yesterday. And it is to Scheffler's credit that he managed to do what he did regardless. I will say this, though, about Scheffler, who I am a huge fan of. He is quite a, he can, like, the prickly side of him came out, I thought, the last 4 days. You know, like, and look, he's perfectly entitled to say to a journalist, he goes, that's a stupid question, even though I don't think it was a stupid question. I thought it was a
pity he didn't say it in a northern accent like Darren Clark.
No.
As he did to me, that's a particularly stupid question.
That was your question, was it?
That's an especially stupid question.
I presume the Golf Weekly lore. This has been discussed at least 25 times over the last 15 years.
I just presumed it was Nathan.
No, Dave McIntyre. But and then also as well as like, and look, he's very analytical, and Scheffler obviously applies a huge amount of method to his approach. And so, look, but he was saying, like, he got the feeling that he felt that he was on the wrong side of the draw, that the conditions didn't favour him on Thursday, Friday. And look, Gary, obviously, like, you know, you pay your money, you play the game. That's the rules, and that's just the way it goes. But on Friday, where the conditions were relatively soft, like, he shot plus two, like, you know, in what was like a very gettable golf course.
These are the margins, you know. You're talking at elite level sport here for one of the four biggest prizes of the year. The margin for error is tiny.
Yeah.
But for him to come back the way he did and bang it around 11 under the weekend with no bogeys is just...
So he's awesome. 12 back of the lead on Friday night. Was it 12?
Was, yeah.
Yeah.
12 back. And a bobble on 17 cost him a very realistic chance of forcing Rory into playing the 18 like perfectly, otherwise it would have been a playoff. Like, that speaks to, you know, that speaks to, like, he's a world number one for a reason.
Yeah, I think it underlines that he's still the best player in the world.
Yeah,
but this, he will be fuming that he hasn't.
You think he'd be fuming?
Oh, yeah. I just think he has. He'll have woken up this morning thinking, how the F have I not won that Masters? Because for the final 2 days, he was comfortably the best player on the golf course. And he'll be so angry with how Friday went.
Yeah.
And how the par fives went for him. But to play the way he did in the final 2 days, like, he probably should, he will feel he should have won it. Rory hit the shots when he needed to. And I don't think he can take anything away from McIlroy. But in Scheffler's mind, he will think to himself, I played the weekend at 11 under, how have I not won that? And yeah, you can point to the putt not dropping at 17, but look, at all the players can point to moments here and there and say, if buts, maybes, you know, if I'd had that, I'd go one way, it would have been different. But
it's a big shot in the arm, though, Dave, for McIlroy's belief system, the fact that, listen, he's going to feel he probably left four or five shots out there for the week too. But he's
the fact
won
that he's beaten Scheffler. It's the first time he's done it.
And
in
he's
a major.
And he's won the first major of the year.
Yeah.
And he's got four more than Scheffler has. Two more.
Yeah. Six versus four.
He's four now already. Bloody hell.
Yeah. Two Masters, an Open, and a PGA.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a good shot in the arm for Rory, too. But Scheffler is undoubtedly, and he's kind of back. You know, there was this hilarious talk because he finished 25th a couple of times that he's, but that's where what his ceiling is. Like, it's frightening to think that.
Yeah.
He's a huge shot in the arm for the game.
Yeah.
Because
it is.
We just don't have a genuine rivalry. Like, there isn't one there. We thought maybe McIlroy DeChambeau was going to bubble up into something, but should they only see each other four times a year? And like, I think the weekend showed up live for what it is, like, all the talk. And honestly, I'm wrong about so much. But I felt all the Ram talk was way over the top. All the data golf statistics that were being put together, like, on shitty golf courses that are not testing him. His around the green stats were way up. And you're thinking, it's not real. Like, I'd far sooner listen to Brandel Chamblee talk about that kind of stuff than I would anybody else. And he has utter disdain for Liv and everything that it is. But he spoke genuinely on Friday about... Or on Wednesday, sorry, when he was with McGinley, as they were previewing the tournament about Ram, he said, look, these stats are not real. They don't stand up in the real light of day when it comes to major championship golf. And that Ram was showing up for what his form is on Thursday and Friday. So, look, none of the live golfers really played well. And at least we get to see Rory.
Finishing third was Tyrrell Hatton.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hatton slipped my mind. He was brilliant. And I love watching Tyrrell Hatton, so I probably have a little bit of bias towards him.
But here's a really important issue, and you think the way these guys think. So his interview afterwards, and he's aware of his situation on Live. I know he plays a bit on DP World, but he was really thinking, I got to make the top 12 going out. I want to be back here next year. And he alluded to the fact that his wife is expecting their first child and hopefully everything goes according to plan there. And he can't wait for his baby to be running around at the par three next year. So whilst everyone wants to win these things, you know, big finishes in majors are crucial to the stepping stone of trying to win them too. And I think he was phenomenal at the US Open. Like, I don't see him finishing his career without a major.
No, I agree. I think.
But there is a question mark on some of the courses. And is that, you know, if you think how tricky Augusta played this week, really.
Okay. Let me ask you this. And so we in our WhatsApp group, we were debating this quite a lot. And the argument was made that Live is a poor setup for a very tough condition, particularly when you're seeing scores of 23, 24 under, you know, winning events. And even considering that they play some very tidy golf courses, that the winning scores on Live are lower. But are they much like I just did a quick kind of back of the envelope maths. So in the 11 events or 12 events leading up to the Masters, the average winning score was 18 under. The highest winning score was 11 under. And that's when, is it Matt Fitzpatrick won at 11? And then we had Scheffler winning at 27 when he won the Amex. Like, yes, you can make the argument, and I know that Brandel did, that the Live courses are too soft, too easy to really challenge, and you know, the top guys. But you'd make that same argument at the PGA setups, with maybe one or two exceptions. They're not really great prep for...
I don't think it's all about the golf courses.
Go on.
I think it's as much the vibe of the tour as
the level of competition.
Yeah, you're kind of, you know, maybe we're a bit old school and all of that too, but it's not as many players. There's no cut. There's no jeopardy.
How many guys are you up against, really?
They're playing... I don't know, there's a lot of really good players on that, but, you know, you're playing in shorts. There's music playing. There's, you know, so... I know they're four-rounders now. I do, unlike you, Dave, I do enjoy watching a bit of it because I like watching professional golf. I like watching people, you know, doing stuff that you can try learn from on that. But I just think the cauldron in preparedness is probably not as similar as playing on, you know, tough weeks on the PGA Tour.
But if you, and again, if to counter-argument that, if you're looking at the performance of the Live players across the majors since the start of Live, they are marginally overrepresented given the number of players on Live versus the number of players on the PGA Tour. So even though the spotlight is on John Rahm and Bryson and they're underperforming, I mean, Bryson, in fairness, didn't underperform last year so much, but like Rahm obviously has. But then you could easily pick out 10 PGA Tour players that are expected to do much, much better and go, well, where the hell were these guys?
Well, the guys that have done well in the majors were doing well in the majors before they went to Live. So it's kind of, you know.
Except for John Rahm. Rahm is a curious... I mean, obviously, we picked him. Certainly, I picked him. I thought he was the favorite to win, given his stats over the course of the year and stunk out the joint, frankly. So
I don't think anyone could have predicted him shooting six over the first day.
No.
Like he's too good a player for that. I think, you know, I don't know what happened to him, whether he was trying too hard and got a bit contrary and lost his way a little bit. But and that happens in golf.
But
you know, no one owns the game, as they say.
If you're looking at Liv, Bryson is the success story. He's gone there. He's won another major since. He's transformed his brand. He's a YouTube sensation and he's winning tournaments and piling up the millions of dollars. The opposite are Rahm and Smith. Their careers have been destroyed by heading over there. Bank balances enhanced massively. But their reputations and their on-course performances have been destroyed. Like John Rahm had a chance to be an all-time great.
I know, but John Rahm is the best player on LIV by a stretch. He's won
But who cares? John Rahm is a two-time major champion, and he was a two-time major champion 4 years ago.
I know, I agree. I'm disappointed that he is where he is.
My argument obviously wouldn't stack up if Rahm had won a major or two, or come really close to winning a major or two since he went to LIV. And obviously the argument for is Bryson. What a career he's having.
It will open up, though. The chairman last night in his speech thanked all the tours and mentioned LIV. So going forward, I do think there's going to be more access for LIV guys to compete in these tournaments.
And that will change the situation then. But if you're taking Rahm as an example of how badly things can go when you make a decision like that, he is the worst case scenario. Cam Smith is also an utter irrelevance.
Well, Cam is on the beach, isn't he?
Yeah, Cam Smith feels on the beach. Rahm doesn't.
Dave, you'll be using that in your soccer commentary in the next couple of weeks about certain teams.
It's like Fulham were on the beach on Saturday.
They're on the beach already, yeah.
Cam Smith's been on the beach for like 3 years.
Yeah.
Thankfully, Fulham were on the beach, Fionn. Liverpool played to be on the beach.
Meanwhile, John Rahm played out his fourth round in the company of a kindergarten child decided to have a massive strop, even though he was second last, I think. Whatever you want to say about Sergio, I think it's terribly, terribly sad to see a player of Sergio's unquestioned ability damage his own reputation and legacy in such a ridiculous manner. And not just, I don't mean what happened yesterday. I just mean there's a whole series of incidences going back a number of years where it's just like, and you've got this idiot now who's going to be hanging around. I can't believe that Justin Rose didn't beat him in 2017, because now you've got this fool hanging around for the next 30 years.
Fionn, I was so happy for Sergio when he won in that playoff.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I wish Rose had beaten him. Oh my! On both sides, I'd love to have seen Rose win last night if it wasn't going to be an Irishman. Sir, there's a line in Shipnuck's new book on Rory that says, from day one, it was clear that McIlroy did not possess the arsehole gene. Sergio Garcia has that in spades.
You know, I used to think, Gary, obviously with all your contacts in the world of golf and all the stories you tell each other. I used to think, you know, do you remember when there used to that, like, where Tiger was very clear that Tiger just didn't like Sergio? I always suspected that this was a bit of kind of alpha male bullshittery on the part of the American golfer against the European. But like, now again, I've never met Sergio, so I don't know anything about him other than what we see and these high profile incidences that he's been involved with. But like, it just feels he doesn't come across as a particularly likable guy. And look, I understand that golf can be very, very frustrating, but like, Jesus Christ, you're second last. Like, what are you doing? Slamming the turf and then destroying your driver for what?
Well, this phrase, he doesn't come across as a particularly likable guy. We're only in April, but that's definitely going to be the award for the biggest understatement of 2026. If you think of where he was after Medina, after Brookline, so those two events pretty much followed each other, didn't they, in 99?
Yeah.
Medina when Woods won the PGA and Sergio's galloping down the fairway and he's trying to play this incredible cut from behind the tree. And we fell in love with him immediately.
Of course, El Nino.
And then on the first 2 days at Brookline, he was probably the best player on the golf course for a whole number of reasons. So his bubbly character and his infectious personality. He was playing on the Friday and the Saturday with Jesper Parnevik. I think they won 3 of 4, if not 4 from 4 points. And he was carrying Parnevik in a bear hug down the fairway. Everyone just thought, this kid is just a brilliant foil for Woods. He's a wonderful bit of fresh air for the game. We can't wait to fall in and stay in love with this guy for years and years. Look where he is now, 27 years later. Reputation torn asunder beyond anybody else, bar maybe Woods, that I could think of.
Gary, I mean, I don't know if there's anything that we don't know about Sergio you know, that would might explain, you know, is he suffering like some terrible frustration in life, or is he deeply unhappy? Or look, you know, you never know what's inside the souls of men. But like, it just felt even like, so the obviously the incident, but even the post round, is it just embarrassment? But the way he behaved was so, he could have easily just gone, guys, that was outrageous. I'm so sorry I did that.
The transcript from his interview afterwards is an embarrassment, really.
When you see the interview, he's got the sunglasses on. The only thing is, he hates the media, and he's perfectly entitled to hate the media. That's fine.
He's in the wrong place because it's an invitation, remember?
Oh, yeah.
You got to get that letter in the post. So,
has anybody not been invited who's eligible ever?
I don't imagine so, but certainly digging up the place is...
there was, in the 70s, there was an African-American golfer, what's his name? Who didn't get invites, even though he ranked high enough on the tour to earn an invite. That had it been a white player, he would have gotten. But obviously that goes back to the dark old days of pre-enlightenment Augusta. Anyway, look, enough about Sergio. I just think Augusta's a funny old place. Poor old Mark Calcavecchia getting chucked out on Friday because he had his phone. It was just like...
Look, the best thing that's happened to Sergio in the last 3 or 4 years is that he's managed, despite finishing second bottom and the players who made the cut, he's managed to pick up 10 minutes of the Postmasters podcast in Golf Weekly. That's quite an achievement.
Yeah, so let's move on. Let's talk about... So I just before we get on to... I want to talk about Shane, obviously, but let's talk about Sam Burns. Look, he had a disappointing final round, finished tied seventh. Like, obviously, the early double kind of set the tone for the rest of the round for him. But, like, you know, bit of a late surge. You know, I don't think he was ever in contention. He was as much in contention as Russell Henley was, I guess.
Well, I think Russell Henley did really well. I think Burns...
Did very, very well.
Burns and Lowry just kind of fed off one another a little bit, and Burns kind of hung in there, didn't leak as much oil as Shane did. Like, Shane had a nightmare final round.
Last year, he shot an 81 on the Sunday, and it was seen as an anomaly. This is like, whatever. He is, what, within 3 shots of the lead at the start of play this yesterday morning and shot an 80. And like almost like, if you wanted to be cruel about it, is that like, because the TV coverage just stopped showing him. So I was just looking at his numbers getting worse and worse and worse on the Masters app. And I'm thinking, hang on a second. Did he put the clubs away and just take out like a hurley and just start like, you know, whacking the ball around? Like,
well, yeah, it was a bad 80 as well. It wasn't like he had made it, you know, a couple of eights or, you know, two or three really bad holes. And other than that, it was just a really poor day. And he's 2 shots behind going out. Like, he's a legitimate chance. He's a legitimate chance of winning this thing. He's in the second last group. And we didn't see him after, what, 4 holes or something?
Now, when we did the preview pod yesterday, or the watch-along pod yesterday, I don't think any of us really thought that Shane, just given everything, was a very real contender to win. But as you said, Gary, you're 2 shots behind. Like, you're on the dance floor, you know, you might as well just dance. I'd be interested to hear Shane kind of talk about it in his own time. But like, given the scar tissue that he has inevitably accrued over the course of this season of just some terrible, terrible faltering finishes, a Cognizant, the Honda, was it at the Arnold Palmer where
he missed the cut there, right?
Yeah, he missed the cut, but he needed just par and didn't get it on the last to make the cut. Look, to what extent, and this is pure guesswork, to what extent do we think that what happened yesterday is part and parcel of the general tone of what's happened to him this season? Or is this just going to add a whole new layer of scar tissue that's going to make it even harder for him to move on?
I think being in contention and losing a tournament is... You know, as late as he did on both events is a totally different vibe to, you know, shooting a million in the last round. sometimes shooting a million in the last round just happens. I know it did happen to him Sunday of last year, which is surprising as to why it would have happened again yesterday. Yeah, it's a big blow. Now, thankfully, he's back in Harbortown this week, and he's a fantastic record.
And he loves it there, yeah.
And he's an ambassador, so he's definitely asked to play, and it's a signature event. And he's playing the week after, too, in Zurich with Brooks Koepka, because he's an ambassador for them as well. But, yeah, I think it's a tough blow, and I think you said this, he's got to get back to basics. He played flawless golf for 3 days. That's the reality.
He played brilliantly. And on Saturday, he was imperious.
He looked really in control. So it's most unusual for a player of that ability to blow out like that. So I don't know what happened. Was he not well or something?
He's a man of interesting contradictions. On the one hand, I think he is a remarkably accomplished golfer who you could make the argument that his status within the game certainly exceeds his win rate. However, he does have an Open Championship on his own island. He was a key figure in multiple Ryder Cups and sank the putt at Bethpage. So he's there. But he hasn't had a PGA ranking event win since 2019, which is the Open. He won at Wentworth in 22, but he hasn't been able to convert, other than the Zurich that he won with Rory. He hasn't been able to just, win on his own card. And I wonder if we know how good he is. We know how brilliant his short game is. We know that he's a streaky putter, but when the putter's blowing hot, he can really put them down. To what extent do you think, Gary, that he's a very natural golfer. He clearly has a swing that's very organic and very himself, but that once pressure, the pressure that would have been there yesterday morning or yesterday afternoon, that once pressure goes on, that natural swing starts to creak.
I don't agree with that. I think tee to green, he's elite level. He has the iron play to win around Augusta. Normally, that's the strongest determining factor in who wins that tournament. I think from the little bit we saw of him yesterday, he missed three very short putts.
Yeah.
He was up and out of three of them very early. He didn't seem to have any conviction on the greens. And maybe, he just lost his way on the greens last night. And then that leaked into the rest of his game. He started shooting at flags to compensate for that. And listen, you can shoot 80 around there in a heartbeat if you're doing that. And it was a tough day too. It was swirly. But his putting, not much different to McIlroy. McIlroy's putting in the last 5-6 years has improved immeasurably. So,
oh my God. Brad Faxon, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And so has Shane. He's improved enormously on the greens as well. He just looked like he needed a good start and he didn't get it. And then he didn't have the answers to those questions.
Can I throw something out there with Shane, lads? Yeah. He was the joint worst player in the field yesterday, and that was only because Hao Tong Li took a 10 on a par 5 at one point. Take that out, and he is the worst player in the field. Emotionally and or physically, has he got the staying power for all 4 days?
Oh, no, he's physically fit enough. No, he's lost a lot of weight. He's
so emotionally,
that's a bit of a myth.
Has he got staying power? It just seems that he doesn't seem to be able to. Oh, look, his
what joints. The actual wow. hell?
Oh, my God.
Wow. Hello, can you hear me?
Okay. God, this is a turn up for the books.
You coming to shut it down?
I swear to Jesus Christ. I swear to God, what does it take for you to show up on the pod, Nathan Murphy, Rory to win the Masters?
Basically, once a year, every year, Rory wins a major. I'm more than happy to rock up and chat about it. Good to see you all.
I'm going to give you a glimpse behind the curtain. In our WhatsApp group, and we have an active WhatsApp group, and we communicate what time we're going to start, what we're going to talk about. We communicate loads of different things. Not once, Brona, I know this is all on Brona, not once was it even hinted at that Nathan Murphy might descend from the lofty heights of Today FM to join us here on Golf Weekly. But you're very, very welcome.
I'm delighted. I probably missed the boat. I was told I'd be on in a minute once Gary's finished making his point, and that was about 8 minutes ago. So I'm glad to see nothing has changed.
Nathan, we haven't really, we've touched on everybody bar Rory. No, I'm kidding. Your overall thoughts, go on.
Well, very straightforward. I don't want to say it was deflating because it was just such a brilliant, brilliant 4 days and had the most worthy winner. But because last year, I think we were all just so emotionally invested and it was as good a night of sport, never mind golf, as we'll ever see, nothing was ever going to live up to that. And it felt early yesterday like, oh, actually, maybe it might. And maybe we will be as emotionally invested here. This felt like a night that we should have had three or four times over the last 12 years, but we just didn't because this Masters became a sort of psychological monster for McIlroy that gave us one of the great storylines in sport. But that he, considering how he won his first four majors, he should have won quite a few Masters like he won last night, where he's just the best player in the world and he just goes and shows it, and he uses all of the experience that he's built up, not just at Augusta, but in his sort of 20 years as a professional golfer to find the right spots. You know, I think there'll be a lot of guys with regrets considering McIlroy wasn't quite at his best all week, yet still had more than enough to hold him off. I think Scheffler's probably going to win every other major this year. He's going to be so furious with what happened on on Friday in particular. When you think he went through the weekend, I was accused last night as I was half cheering for Scheffler of being, you know, a bit too much of a love-in for Scotty. If you think he shot bogey-free Saturday and Sunday, which is the first time since 1942?
And that's only since records began at Augusta. They don't have records pre-1942.
And as well as that, he had the best score of all the late starters on Thursday. That's how he doesn't end up winning this Masters, I'm not quite sure. But yeah, listen, I was just delighted. It sort of reinforced all of the conversations we had this day 12 months ago about where Rory's position is in terms of greatest Irish sports people, greatest European golfer. And just sort of a more satisfaction than exhilaration today.
So you join us then right at the kind of the nice kind of, we've discussed the key moments, or certainly what we think were the key moments throughout. Obviously the birdies on 7 and 8 after the double on 4. His beautiful controlled 9-iron on 12, the manner in which he got out of the bunker, short game, we talked about his elite level short game. So what I guess we want to get to is what does it all mean? And I'm going to put a question to the three of you here. Kind of, Nathan, you kind of touched on this point. Is it like, you'd almost ask the question, given his performances over the last 2 years, the question is like, where the hell have you been for the last 11? Like, you're consistently the best golfer in the world. We pointed it out many, many times. He's consistently in the top 10. He is the best golfer of his generation, bar none, in terms of sheer consistency since the day he turned pro. Like, I appreciate that Scottie Scheffler is number one in the world now, and, you know, maybe will go on to be one of the best golfers of all time. But, like, the way he won last night, having gotten the monkey off his back last year, to me, it raises a number of interesting questions, not least, like, did it take 11 years of pain and experience and turmoil and hope and everything to be where he is now? You're
flummoxed. Go on, Gary.
Go on.
No, Nathan, you're fresh. Off you go.
I think it did. I think it just further proved that the Masters had got into his head.
Yeah.
That this was, there's no reason why he shouldn't have won at this course before now, except it was the first major of the year. There's 6 months of pressure building up. It's the only story in golf. Can he complete the career Grand Slam? And we've seen this in lots of parts of his career when he had issues on a Friday, he had issues on a Sunday, he had issues with his putting, he had issues with his short game. He figured a way out with all of them. He could just never figure out a way with Augusta. And yeah, I think it was clearly he has broken through that mental barrier now. And as sort of Freddie Couples said, it's hard to not see him winning this every year. It's hard to not see him contending. And one of the brilliant things is that, you know, he's not yet 40. You've got to imagine he's going to put himself in the mix three or four times again in the next decade. And that's because he's such an exhilarating watch. It's incredibly exciting. And look, we all look, maybe with the exception of Gary, who's been a true believer the whole way through, but I think all the three of us, myself, yourself and Dave, have probably all at various stages gone from he's going to win 10 majors, so he's never going to win another one, to right now again going, oof. You know, he's definitely, he's got a good opportunity to get close to double figures. And I did wonder this week, like it felt like this was, and again, typical Rory style, overstating the importance of one tournament, an important week just as to what comes next, because he obviously hadn't won with the exception of the Irish Open since last year. Is he going to go into a Brooks style career now? Obviously, Brooks did it at his peak, but Rory, natural cycle of going, I don't really care about any of these events. I'll turn up and I'll play them. But four times a year, every single thing, you know, even much like the comment on Irish food, probably didn't need to go as hard as he did of like these, you know, three terrible tournaments in the build up to the Masters. I'm never going to go near these shit tournaments.
It was really like, quite something, wasn't it? Like, yeah.
you know, you can think it, you just don't always need to say it. But I think that's going to be his philosophy is, listen, these four tournaments are the only ones that matter. The Ryder Cup, I love it, so I'm always going to give myself a best chance. The Irish Open, I'm always going to be the best player, so I'm always going to have a decent chance. But aside from that, I'll go either where I want to go or where the money takes me. And me going along with what's best for the PGA Tour, that's done. And yeah, peak four times a year and see where it gets him.
So, and Dave, so okay, so last year he accomplished something that, you know, obviously Tiger did it in 2019, but before him, Ben Crenshaw, Hale Irwin, and a long time ago, Julius Boros, is that, you know, there 11-year gap between majors. But unlike all the others, including Tiger Woods, with Rory, you don't get the feeling this is coming at the end of a career or as like kind of a nice garland to you know, to cap a sunset. Like, he's 36, he's going to be 37 soon, but he is in unbelievably good shape. He's still incredibly young. He's still incredibly relevant. And so unlike the others, that 11-year gap could potentially make the second, I won't say the second half of the career, but the second part of his career even more interesting.
Yeah, there's a few things there I want to pick up on, a couple of that Nathan said. You're right. He's at this is the beginning of the end of the final third of his career. And he has the sort of golf swing and the physical attributes and the dedication to maintaining his physical condition to suggest that he can be inspired by Justin Rose and Phil Mickelson and play competitively when it comes to the majors well into his 40s. And I was hoping the conversation would eventually wheel its way around to where it has done with Nathan there, because he doesn't owe anything to anybody. And when he went out there on a limb for the PGA Tour, eventually they absolutely screwed him. And yeah. I know there's a new PGA Tour schedule being put together at the moment where there's going to be more signature events, and they're again the old adage, we're trying to get the best players in the world playing against each other more often. I honestly think Rory McIlroy should just throw that in the bin as regards his own personal schedule. He shouldn't be playing more than 15 times a season. He should do what he did last year, go to India, go to Australia, go to Ireland, play the events in the places that he wants to play. Money is an absolute irrelevance to him. His PGA Tour legacy, he's never going to win 60, 70 PGA Tour events. That's an irrelevance. He is measured in majors now. And he needs to make sure that every time he tees it up in a major that he's in the best physical and mental condition possible, doesn't owe the PGA Tour anything at all as regards showing up for some of these events. It's not like he can't get into any event he wants if he just rings him late on and says, oh, by the way, I do want to play at Jack's Place at the Memorial. Can you add me to the field 2 weeks out if he thinks he needs a bit of fine tuning? I think he should taper the way he plays the game now for the next 10 years. We'd asked this question years ago when he was in the midst of his drought. If he held it together on the Sunday in 2011, how many majors would he have won? I honestly think he'd be in double figures now. The fact that it was the Masters that eluded him was so significant for so many reasons. The fact that it built up all that scar tissue, the fact that it's the first major of the year, and so the gap between the PGA Championship as it used to be and now the Open is so long, so the anticipation just builds up to the one major that he didn't have on a CV when it came to the Grand Slam, and then the fact that it's the only major that's played on the same course every season. When you threw all that in together, it just amounted to this emotional turmoil that worsened year in, year out. If he managed to get over the line in 2011, I just think he flies through the Grand Slam and wins upwards of 10. But here we are now and he's on 6, and his body is incredible physical condition. At his age now, he's still driving the ball further than anybody else, bar maybe Bryson. Yeah. And he is not going to rock up to Augusta and drive the ball as badly as he did this week very often over the next 7 or 8 years.
Sir. Just on that, before we move on, sorry, Dave, I want you to finish that point, but can we just, something we didn't mention. On Saturday evening, he went to the range with Harry and he talked about, and this one's for you, Gary, like he obviously had a little bit of the pulls. He wasn't clearing his lower half, so he was kind of flipping it a bit. And in half an hour, whether it's Harry, he said to Harry, here, Harry, video me. And then he could see his own swing and go, or they sent it to Michael Bannon. I don't know, whatever it was. But it seems like two guys sitting on the range late on a Saturday evening seemed to fix the issue at that he didn't have the pulls on Sunday morning. Like, to what extent, I mean, is that to you, Gary, to your trained ear, is that just like ordinary stuff, or does that speak to, I don't know, something pretty amazing?
I know it's pretty basic, and he's got his track man there as well. So, you know, his path was too far out to the right, so he's trying to hit cut shots to neutralize his path. So he's going to get his path a little more to the left, and then he's more control of the club face, and then he can turn off it, and he can commit to shots if you're going to try turn off it and the club is too far inside you, you're just going to block the shit out of it or flip it the other way. So, and he fixed that. He doesn't really, I think his relationship with Michael Bannon, where there was, might've been a phone call, but he's not massively, and he's dead right too, into having coaches hanging out of him all the time. Yeah. You see that all the time with certain players, you know, and it's more of a comfort blanket. And I think you take a bit of ownership, you know, and with Trackman now and GC Quad and all these devices, that the guesswork is taken out of it really for these.
Although
players.
I did hear, I was watching the Golf Channel, don't ask me how, but I saw Brad Faxon and Jim Furyk both, they laughed and referred to Trackman as the drama box. They went, this is the thing that causes more problems than it solves. And they were like, they were very much advocates of just go out, feel it and hit it, will you?
I think Gary, when he said it's pretty basic, it's funny because something I noticed over the weekend, I went back on X for the first time in a long time because I was like, Masters weekend is always a fun weekend.
Yeah.
On Twitter, you want it. And it's something that struck me last night is, and all, we're all sort of guilty of it, of everyone's trying to find a unique way of looking at things. And so many of the golf journalists now are building things up to be something they're not. Of, I'm going to write a beautiful 400-word tweet of, I sat behind the range on Saturday as Rory and Harry looked deep into each other's eyes like they were 2 7-year-old boys back in the fair in the links of Northern Ireland, and between them they managed to figure it all out. And it's like, no, he did exactly as he would do every time you're struggling off the tee. He went to the range for an hour, sorted out a few things. First few holes still didn't work grand, and then somehow he managed to switch it on from 7 on. That there's an over reading into absolutely everything that we're probably all guilty of.
Then at times, and it's probably the genius of Michael Bannon too, then at times you can have a coach that who's trying to be more clever than he actually is, and you can complicate the issue as well. And sometimes, you know, as the old line, you know, your ball flight's your best coach. And he just, golf is a game of opposites. So he started doing the opposite to what he was doing, and he neutralized his path and got a bit of confidence from that. And because there was, you know, a big chat Saturday evening, should he go to the range? And obviously, that's what he did. A lot of great players over the course of years have never hit balls after they play. But the fact that he's such a late tee time on Sunday, it's a different feel to teeing off very early the next day. But yeah, he worked it out. And the big thing is, this is nearly the start of Rory 2.0, you would say, because he would learn massively. Like last year, we all thought he was going to go and dominate, but we didn't realize the gravity of what the Masters took out of him. And now he seems to be looking forward rather than reminiscing on what he's achieved. And that's a pretty potent combination, I would imagine.
Nathan, you said that, like, with your pals, that you were there was active discussion on whether this made him the greatest Irish sportsman. I mean, I'd be curious as to what you think. But the other one is does this not make for one of the greatest golfing stories of all time? Just by dint of the fact that, like, look, last year he won the Grand Slam. So he joins an elite group of now six or five, whatever, six. And then yesterday he joined an even more elite group of four, joining three others who have repeated at the Masters. And having done so with this 11-year gap, and that for me is key, is that 11-year gap. Because if he had done it all in a kind of more compressed timeline, you're like, okay, his brilliance is being rewarded. But to have the longevity that he's had, does it not make this one of the greatest golfing stories of all time?
It does, but it was that last year as well. To be honest, this doesn't, and we're speaking on a golf podcast, I think maybe for the people who tune in for the Masters every year or for the majors, it maybe reinforces things for them. And look, Nick Faldo's on commentary last night. We probably would have all felt he was the greatest European golfer, McIlroy, after what he did last year, because he won the Grand Slam. Mm-hmm. But Faldo had won more majors. Now they've won the same amount of majors. Obviously, Harry Vardon, seven, all of that. Impossible to compare to 100 years ago. But all of the superlatives you can say about McIlroy, I felt we probably said 12 months ago, and this just reinforces it. And there's the longevity, there's the very short list. But it's just the drama, I think, that he provided along the way and how invested we were in it. Like, and look, we're looking a little bit through green-tinted glasses because, you know, even chatting with Shane Ryan a couple of weeks ago, I don't see any way any final round can compare to what happened last year. And he was, 2019 Tiger. And I'm like, nah. But then again, you know, maybe if you're an American, you're looking at Tiger and what he means to sort of the American dream and all of that, you look at it slightly differently. But yeah, every single superlative, our greatest ever sports person, the greatest ever European golfer, like, you know, starting out with the talent at 3-4 years of age to fulfill it all, like anything you want to throw at him, he fully deserves it.
Dave, Gary, do you want to add some?
Well, to answer the question, like, he's undoubtedly Ireland's greatest ever sports person. I'm Pádraig Harrington's biggest fan. He's probably our greatest ever ambassador. But
Pádraig Harrington would probably argue that Rory was Ireland's greatest ever sports person.
Yeah, he is. And at 37, he's probably got realistically 32 maybe good tries at majors. And if he could pick, you know, if he got 10% of those, would be a pretty good return. So I think there's plenty more left in the locker. 10% might be a poor return. So I think we're set for some fantastic viewing going forward. And there seems to be an energy about this too, very different to last year's energy. He's not playing this week. Signature event, Harbortown. He's taken a break to probably belt into a load of Rothschild for the week, maybe. So, and good luck to him, and richly deserved. So, yeah, it's a really exciting space. And Dave made a great point too about there's a bit of a rivalry going on here as well, which was a little bit false a couple of years ago with him and Scheffler, because Scheffler was just that much better. But Rory's got the first major of the year, and that's going to irk Scheffler. And Rory knows he has to improve to get back to world number one. And that's an exciting thing for someone who's achieved so much.
Mm-hmm. Dave?
You know, just that desire to get up every morning and do his gym work and do his prep and do his putting and his short game and still continue to try to figure stuff out, because that's the way this game is. You'll never, like, I was out practicing early this morning and I think I found the secret again. So it's a kind of sport that, you know, you're forever trying to seek solutions.
Well, I'll tell you one thing for sure is that we'll never see Rory teeing it up at Valero ever again. So that's for damn sure.
I like I said on the rivalry thing, Fiona, I just cannot wait for Ranomink next month. I can't, 4 weeks, it seems too long for the PGA Championship. In fact, I haven't as looked as forward as much to a PGA as I am going to this one. Now, Nathan's point is he the greatest ever Irish sports person? Look, he's definitely in the argument, isn't he? But I've always looked at that argument as in comparison to Ireland's most beloved sports person. And in similar terms, I think you could argue numbers-wise, Robbie Keane is the greatest Irish footballer of all time. He's not in the top five most beloved Irish footballers of all time. I mean, that gong probably goes to McGrath or Giles or Brady or somebody like that. I used to think there was a massive gap between Rory in terms of him being our greatest sports person and our most beloved sports person. Six majors, and I think he's going to finish on 8 or 9. I mean, it'll be on doubt. You know, the greats, the Katie Taylors and the Christy Rings, and look, it's an endless list of these great sports people once we look back on it with the historical eyeglasses in years to come. But I think the gap between McIlroy when it comes to the most beloved and the greatest has narrowed massively. I think we are really falling in love with this guy all over again. And I think that will deepen further as we look upon him growing old, losing his hair, graying a little bit. At some point, maybe a little bit of a paunch there in the midriff when he can't hit the gym as often as he does. And when he's contending at Augusta on the back nine on a Sunday, or maybe making a big run on a Saturday in his mid-40s, we are going to love this guy as much and more than we ever have, perhaps. And I do think there's still a chance that we could love him as much, if not more, than we do Shane and Porrig and the great sports people who've always had our hearts in their hands. The next 10 years is going to be fascinating.
Just to put a little fly in your ointment there, Dave, do you think we in Ireland, do you think that he will still be as loved come June when in the birthday honours list, it's Arise Sir Rory McIlroy?
I've never been one to pay too much attention to that. Other listeners to our podcast might have different opinions on it, but that development, whether it happens or not, will be an irrelevance to me personally.
Yeah, fair enough. Go on.
Fionn, the other big thing as well is, you know, if we think back to when we were kids and watching the early editions of Augusta, and, you know, a lot of people got into the sport because of that. So, you know, is last night or last year going to create, we are kind of bereft of representation on the main tour at the moment. So,
no, it's true.
You know, is last night going to create like an excitement for kids going forward? There's no doubt it will be.
Certainly, it brought me back, like, to, I thought it afterwards, but 86, Nicholas winning, because I used to watch it with my great aunts who were golf mad and members of Hermitage. And so even though as a kid, I didn't care about golf, but like it was on in the house. So you'd watch and you'd get entranced by it. And particularly with my aunts talking about it. So you're kind of invested in the outcomes. And was it Langer won in 85? I think so. That might be my first real kind of tangible memory of the Masters. And then more or less ever since, Mize in 87, Sandy Lyle in 88, Faldo 89, was that his first one? And so on and so on thereafter. But like, you know, no, absolutely. I think the Masters makes non-golf fans like golf, even just for 4 days a year, and long may it last. Nathan, so you're a happy man today. So you've descended, you've come down to join us, however briefly. So I thank you.
That's my cue to piss off again.
No, I think we're done. I think we're all done.
To piss off, Nathan.
I think we're done. I think
you're
we're
saving the good stuff. I was waiting for a Gary Murphy Sergio rant.
We did that.
Oh no!
Oh, you missed it.
I listen back.
You should listen back.
I tell you a quick story about Sergio.
Go on.
I was doing a corporate. I was commentating over in Dubai, and I was in a bar one night with Hopper, who was Garcia's caddy, and I suggested to Hopper part of the issue that Sergio might have on the greens is his body language. And he walks, in my opinion, around the putt and around the green way too slowly. And hence, he's a very poor energy in his stroke. He always struggled with speed. So I said it to Hopper, would you not think you might suggest that to him? And he literally looked at me like I was talking a different language. That the idea of suggesting something to Sergio does not exist in this dojo. And like the disdain he had towards me for even thinking that someone could say something like that to Sergio. So that's the kind of character you're dealing with.
Is it that Sergio just didn't listen to anybody, or he certainly wasn't going to listen to his caddy?
Probably anybody, I'd imagine.
It was more that he was never going to listen to anything that Gary Murphy might have suggested.
That's true, yeah.
That could have been, and that's why I prefaced my remarks to let it be his idea. And no, Sergio doesn't listen to anybody.
Yeah. Hey, look, we didn't hold back, Nathan. It was about,
okay,
it was about 40 minutes ago.
And and what about Nick Faldo on commentary?
I loved it.
Go on.
I'm with Dave. I was discussing this in the office this morning of the whole way through. I'm going, is this, he's not having any level of expertise because he can't accept that golf is not where it was 20, 30 years ago. But he's become this very reassuring voice of, well, he obviously does know what he's talking about because he's done this so many times. And it feels as though he's becoming more self-deprecating. And the bit when McIlroy, like, it's all come down to this. Finally, there's a bit of drama on the back nine when McIlroy goes in on 18. And Faldo decides, now is a good time for me to tell the story of when I was laid up for 3 months and took a particular interest in trees. And I'm now going to describe what happens when you're around trees for a considerable period and the peace that can bring you. And Ewan Murray brilliantly just goes, we need to bring him for a drink.
Yeah. I was watching, so I watched last night, I watched the US commentary. So I like Trevor Immelman a lot. I think he's really, really good. I think Dottie, I just as a pair, I just think they're brilliant. But on Friday, I think it was, I think Butch was on. You know, they use them sporadically. But Hao Tong Lee was on the course, and Butch at one point goes, ah, he's a real fun guy. And the tone in which he said it said to me, he goes, Butch has absolutely no idea what Hao Tong Lee is like, but he just looks like a bit of a quirky fella. So I'm just going to say it. And it was like, I feel that way sometimes, that Nick has kind of ascended to that kind of like, look, I'm just going to start telling rando stories now, you know, and it's all good, you know.
Oh, it was great having Butch back on the coverage as well.
Was it though?
Oh, was it? But again, I'm not looking for, I think, like, the Masters is just a beautiful 4 days. I've found myself watching more golf than I ever have because the kids are so into it now. So I'm
sure
every Saturday and Sunday night is now nothing else can be done because we're watching the Valero Texas Open. Yeah. And you get your nerdy golf coverage and all of the stats. I just think you cannot but smile when Butch just goes, attaboy, Rosie.
That's the one. I was literally in my head as you were talking, I was going, the one thing I love from Butch is attaboy, Rosie. It's one of the great utterances there is, attaboy.
It's like
Rosie.
A warm blanket when Butch comes out with that stuff. One of the funniest moments for me on commentary was when Rose hit a second into 15 and the shot tracer was sending the ball in a direction, but that both Faldo and Butch thought, he's in big trouble here. Ball lands 8 feet behind the pin, sets up an eagle putt that obviously he three putted, so actually walked off with what felt like was a bogey. But immediately, the reaction of the two of them was to blame the shot tracer guy. I said, oh, well, obviously, I think Faldo said, even the shot tracer guy can lose his cool under pressure sometimes. I'm not sure the shot tracer guy actually did get it wrong. I think it might have been spot on, but I'd say the two of them looked at each other and said, let's throw him under the bus rather than admit that maybe one or the two of us might have misread where Rose was sending this second.
I mean, look, whichever way you cut it, it's terrific stuff. And look, we're blessed to have the experience. I think, Dave, you opened this up at the very, very start, which seemed like 3.5 weeks ago when we first started this podcast, that you said that you don't envy anyone who can't enjoy the Masters.
I pity.
You pity.
I pity those who don't love the Masters.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's just, it's 4 days of just, although my wife, God bless her, my wife who on Saturday, so I'm in a couple of WhatsApp groups, and I think over the course of the evening, comfortably 900,000 messages are exchanged. You know, I think we all know that feeling. And my wife at one point like kind of gets up and goes, all right, I'm going to bed. And I'm like, look what's happening. Like, it's, and she goes, you're sitting here watching golf, chatting to your friends. I like, this is nothing to do with me. And I was like, oh, okay. Right. See ya.
All those beautiful places you go, Fionn, to explain to the Masters how wonderful they are over their airwaves. You could organize maybe a nice trip for next year, the week of the Masters, so you can have the TV to yourself.
Do you know what, though? And again, I've never been, so I'm happy to be entirely wrong. Nathan, you've been. Gary, I think you've been. Have you been?
Yeah, I've been three times, yeah.
Okay, so, and Dave, I don't know, you haven't been, have you?
No.
Okay,
no,
so you and I are the ones who haven't been. My understanding is this, right? The best time to go to the Masters is the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday practice rounds, where you have the freedom of the place, relatively speaking. You're allowed to take cameras on, no phones, as Mark Calcavecchia discovered to his... and that's the fun part. But that once the tournament starts, it just suffers from the same thing that all golf tournaments suffers, is that crowds and it's just a bit tough to... am I wrong, Nathan?
No, No. It's
the crowds are... Like every year I try and research it and find out how many people they let in, but there can be no more than 10,000 people on the entire property on the Sunday. I'm looking at the numbers and the depths of the crowd. Compare that to say 50,000 or 60,000 at an Open Championship. Mm-hmm. Like you watch McIlroy walking up. Was it the? And I know there's different parts of the course are inaccessible and things like that. Like. You know, even on 12, like that's walking along the fairway at an Open, the amount of people that are sort of four or five deep. Like it's, and I said this when I came back, that if, and you're the type of person who might find himself somehow in Augusta on a random November day, that if you were there on a Monday and they said it's going to cost you £100 to just walk around here, I would recommend paying it. Like
sure,
every single piece of it is just history and looking at an angle and remember this shot, and it's just perfection. It is without question the happiest place I have ever been in my life.
Wow.
Snap. Yeah, really? it is someday. There's something, I don't know what it is, but there's something spiritual about the place. So
the internet tells me, Nathan, between 35,000 and 40,000 on tournament days.
A day. I just don't see how, when you compare it to an Open and you look at the crowds and it's such a tight property, and like you can park there, you can drive up to it, you don't need to get a shuttle bus from half an hour away. Yeah, maybe. But yeah, if you can go, I saw this year that they've clamped down massively on not just touting, but reusing the tickets. You'll remember your mate Ivor, who I met outside when I was there, and Ivor driven down overnight from Nashville and was like, I have no ticket. And I'm like, well, I barely have a ticket myself. And I was walking out to the car with my bags full from the merchandising tent. And Ivor's walking in with his good wife. And it's like, yeah, some guy just gave us 2 tickets outside for £50. He was heading home for the day.
Right.
That's gone, I think. So. Yeah.
And I just saw that John Huggan had written a piece for some Australian golf magazine, and in it he was kind of decrying, like, say, for example, the way the media center is just miles away from anywhere, or that they're not, you know, that this is a course that has a healthy disdain for members of the Fourth Estate.
Sorry, the media center is...
It's down off the first.
10-minute wall. The media center is at the end of the driving range. And it's the most luxurious media center
again,
that has ever existed, and
I
it's 10 minutes from the first tee.
Yeah. All right.
Like the greatest moment, if the greatest moment at Augusta is you walk in, the merchandising tent is on your tent. I say nothing is a tent at Augusta. The merchandising house, this palatial palace, is just on your right hand side. And you walk in, you see the course for the first time. And right in front of you is the first tee, the second green, the ninth green, the 18th green, and the 10th tee, all within what, Gary? 100 meters of each other? 50 yep. meters of each other?
Yeah.
And you're like, this might be as good as it gets. There's no better view in the world.
Okay. I've
whatever
got a couple
it costs
more
to
questions
go, spend it.
For you, Nathan. I have a couple of questions, but I know, Dave, you have to jump.
I do. This is, I've enjoyed every minute of this, but it's gone on even longer than I am comfortable with.
All right. Dave. Listen, thanks very much.
Lads, happy Masters Week. I can't believe it's 12 months till we can luxuriate in this all over again.
There's the Open Championship. What are you talking about?
I know. And that's amazing. But look, the Masters, as David McGrain would say, the Masters is the Masters.
The Masters is the
imagine,
Masters.
Imagine when I went to the Masters, I met Damian McGrain at the Masters. So I had Damian McGrain talking to me about the Masters at the bat. Like that's bucket list stuff. That's a bit of bucket list stuff
good.
That you know most people can't even pay for.
On that incredible note, and homage to one of Ireland's greatest golfers, Mr. McGrain, I bid you adieu.
Cheers, Dave.
See you,
come here to me, Nathan, just in the last couple of minutes as we drag the arse out of this podcast. When you were there, were you there for all 4 days? Were you there for the Sunday?
No. I was going to go down again on the Sunday if Rory was in the mix. Because a strange quirk of the Masters is Sunday is the easiest day to get tickets to if it's not Tiger or somebody.
Because
they're all going to Mass on a Sunday or to service or whatever it is. And, you know, it's obviously
Cam Young was at services on Sunday.
Very
morning,
religious part
way.
Of the world. So it's a day of rest. So actually, and also a lot of people fly back because they're working on Monday. So it is the, so I was not there. John Rahm won the year I was there on the Sunday, unfortunately.
Right. And Gary, when you were you there in a working capacity, in a friend of a player's capacity, in a...
I was there in 93, 94 because I was in university. And the first year we got tickets through John Tosha because his son Craig was my roommate in college. And
right.
Toshak was friendly with Sergio, who was Alathabal's manager, who's no longer with us. And then in 94, my other roommate lived in Augusta and his grandmother was one of the houses that's been bought up actually. And that house got four tickets. So we would go in the morning up to lunchtime and then come out and pass the ticket on to someone else. And so I did that in 94 and I was back working there in 2015.
And I guess, because one of the things that when I was saying that I remember the Masters in the mid 80s and what I do remember, certainly on this side of the ocean, I mean, obviously the Masters was the Masters, but if you were interested in golf on this side of the world, the Open Championship would have been more important or have more cachet, and maybe even the US Open because of the very nature of the openness of it. But certainly fast forward, you know, 40 odd years, and like obviously the numbers show it, but the Masters is by far and away the most important golf tournament in the world, all over the world.
And they increased the prize fund this year as well. So it's the richest of the four majors. Now, I don't know if the others are going to...
But when you were there in the 90s, did it have the same kind of feel as it did in 2015?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in my eyes, I always looked at the Masters and the Open as the two biggest majors. Now, I think the US Open is huge too because it's a national open, but... I would, you know, when you're dreaming as a kid, it would have been, I want to win the Masters and the Open. Yeah. They've always been the two significant majors of the four for me. It was all, like, that was my first introduction to golf. When I saw Sandy Lyle, that was my first, God, that looks pretty, 87, 88? Yeah, or 87. 88, yeah.
88.
Yeah. Yeah,
Larry Myers chipping in on 87. That was it. Anyway, for Nathan and I, it's like our dream was just to go to the Masters, not play in the Masters. But although, mind you, I'm 58 and I still dream of playing professional golf. So, I mean, it's a dream, so it'll never come true, but who cares? That's what life is for, isn't it? Dreaming of it.
It's the hope that kills your film.
When are you out again, Gary? When are you out again?
I'm away in Barbados next week.
I've never met a man who ought to struggle to get invites. It's difficult. Oh, Barbados, yeah, I'm there.
No, I was in Barbados last week, Nathan.
Listen, you two boys, this is why I had to leave this thing. I'm sickened.
It's so come here. Actually,
of reality every week.
So just to give the listeners just something. So I waited. So I did a couple of interesting interviews. So I had a good chat with Sophie Carr, who's Roddy Carr's daughter and a terrific golfer in her own right. Certainly prodigious driver of the ball. But she, you know, as we know, Roddy is connected. He and Ron Kirby did the redesign of Apes Hill, which is where the Legends event is taking place. In whatever, is it a couple of weeks' time, Gary?
Friday week.
So anyway, so I was chatting to Sophie about the work that the Cars have done there and just about golf generally in Barbados. So what I was going to do was I'm going to hold over that until, Gary, you got back from Barbados, and then we could have kind of like a Barbados themed Irish in Barbados type pod.
It's an amazing backstory, isn't it, about the Irish?
Look, I don't want to, like, it is a remarkable story, and it is really Roddy going out there 40 odd plus years ago with his wife, liking the island. And look, the Irish connections between obviously Sandy Lane, but also Digicel, and like there's like deep Irish roots in the place. And I'm sorry, they go back even 400 years.
Indentured
laborers sent out there by Cromwell to work the sugarcane plantations. But I mean, in terms of like in a golf sense. So it was really, really interesting. And I will say this, Apes Hill is one of the most beautiful golf courses I have ever been on in my life. I also was lucky enough to play Royal Westmoreland, which is an amazing track. And I also played Barbados Golf Club. This is just to annoy you, Nathan, which is one of the friendliest places I've ever been to. I don't know if you know it, Gary.
Barbados, no, I haven't played it, no.
Like, it's a Muni track, okay? And so even though the fairways are fairly burnt out, but the greens, and this is all Roddy Carr, they put so much emphasis on making the greens pristine, and they are just that. Then afterwards, in the clubhouse, which isn't really, it's just like kind of thatched roof, there's like loads of locals playing dominoes and having the beers, and it's just a brilliant atmosphere. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I have to say, I really, really enjoyed it. So anyway, look, we'll talk about
it. I'm delighted for both of you.
Thanks, Nathan. That's why
I'll just go back to my desk.
Nathan, right, I'm going out to work. He was on a junket. Totally different thing.
Yeah.
I know. Listen, but I had to work as well. You can read about it in the pages of the Irish Independent. Anyway, look, lads, again, Nathan, a pleasure. I'm thrilled that you jumped on.
Thanks for having me. I'm sorry. I missed the first hour.
You did miss the first hour.
Nathan, you have to go back now and put your shirt and tie on, is it?
That's it, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Find out what the best song of the century is.
Wow. That's the sort of, yeah, that's my life now.
That's good. Sorry.
It's good. No, it's great. It's great. Yeah. I'm still here myself. And Shane Ryan still have great fun on a Thursday.
I know you do. We had Shane on the watch along yesterday.
You have to slag him about his predictions, Nathan.
Why? What was he saying?
Well, he went for Cam Young, as did I, by the way. And
as far out as Tusker Lighthouse he was.
Yeah. I'll avoid Shane Lowry chat with Shane, I think.
Oh, man, that was terrible. That was hard, wasn't it?
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money down the drain. There's £1 million in 4 hours gone.
Oh, listen. Anyway.
I think he got 70 grand.
70 grand?
Yeah, which sounds like a lot of money, and it obviously is a lot of money, but it's a lot less than 4.5 million. Yeah, and a lifetime exemption.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, go on, lads.
Thanks, lads.
See you guys. Good
to see
you. Thanks, Matt.
All right. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye. All my exes wear Rolex, but I reside right here in Dardanelle. All pick it down. Oh. Little J.D. Starter kid right here.